You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
And we are back. So, what are we smoking this week, Brad?
We are smoking the Christoph San Andreas. And, this is going to be a San Andreas Mexico wrapper, Ecuadorian Habano seed with a triple Nicaraguan Habano seed filler. Yeah, let's just go ahead and start the show properly.
Yeah.
And
this is a brand new cigar. This was just debuted at this year's IPCPR. And I got to say, this is kind of turning into one of my new regular smokes. I've had two or three of these since they came out. And, man, like this Mexican San Andreas wrapper is kind of turned into one of my new favorites.
Yeah, this is my first time having this cigar, and I'm only in the first third of it. But I got to say, it's smooth, it's creamy, but it's also got a little bit of a nutty feel to it. I mean, it's very well balanced, but it's also still, they're on that complex side of things, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's a medium strength cigar, but a full flavor cigar. So yeah, you're not going to get the overwhelming power, but there is a, like I said, if you are a strong cigar smoker, it's definitely on the higher end of the medium scale, but a lot of flavor, a lot of coffee notes, more creamy toward the end from what I hear, or from experience from, like I said, this is like my third or fourth of these I've had. And like I said, this is part of the new stuff that, I mean, it's so new, it's not even on their website, but if you, Google Christoph San Andreas, you can find out more information. But yeah, this is one of their brand new smokes.
One of the things, I don't really know if this is a marketing ploy per se or not, but on the wrapper itself, it's dubbed as elite Cuban taste. Oftentimes I see things like that and I'm like, it's a trap.
Well, they're trying to do like a throwback to the old school Cuban style of doing things. And even their box and stuff look a little bit more older, ruggeder. It's not as sleek and fancy as some of the other cigars. And they always have their signature little pigtail wrapper on the cap.
Yep. And so, I noticed the
that's how you're getting a Christoph, if you see the pigtail.
The foot of the cigar was closed too. It was encased in a complete wrapper, which was a different experience. I haven't smoked too many Christoph cigars, but I'm with you, man. There's something about this that, this is a mellow smoke. This is one that you could very easily do a pairing because you don't have complex taste all over the spectrum, but there's enough of a complexity that, it keeps you involved with the smoke. It doesn't seem to be boring. I'm really digging this one. This might replace the Super Ligero for me.
Yeah, and like we talked to Glenn Case back in the summer at the Southern Cigar Festival, and I was talking to him about the Maduro, which is probably one of my favorite cigars. And yeah, this, most of your Christophs, you're gonna get that pigtail, and like I said, the foot's usually got a little bit of extra wrap on it. This is a 6x60 ring gauge. A lot of the Christophs, I think it's the first Christoph I've seen in this ring gauge, or at least the ones I've smoked.
Yeah, because a lot of them, you see the Robusto that I see a lot, the 5.5x54s, and then
yeah, you either see those or the Churchill is pretty much at least the places I go, they're the standard thing they hit. So yeah, getting a nice 6x60 from Christoph is definitely a good change. And I'm also pairing this with a little bit of bullet bourbon this week, so there's been some other Christoph cigars recommended, pairing with some bourbon, and I gotta say, this is pairing very nicely.
Yeah, I mean, without having the complexity all over the place, I imagine probably the oakiness of the bourbon and everything going with the well balance of the cigar is probably making an awesome combo.
Yep, like I said, I'll find myself smoking one cigar for like a while until I just need to change up my flavor profile, and like I said, this may be my new regular smoke, because I've been smoking a lot of these since they came out.
Yeah, I mean, once again, I would still say that, you know, I think this is what, right at the $10 price point. So, I mean, it's still a very budget-friendly cigar, and, you know, I mean, I'm finding myself more and more, you know, discovering cigars like this that, you know, it doesn't always have to be a, you know, $30, $40 cigar to make it a good stick. So, you know, definitely broadening my horizons. So I'm really digging this.
All right. And this week, we're going to get a little metal up in here and talk about some of our favorite fictional bands. So stay tuned. Ready to rock.
I'm Dr. Roxo for this episode.
Yeah, this time around we're talking about how traditionally, you know, rock and roll music has really been an influence on animation, cartoons, and like I said, you know, we've seen with, you know, the Disney properties that there's, you know, the music from those are almost more popular than the films, but those aren't like what we would call rock and roll most of the time. But rock and roll specifically, as it's, you know, been definitely a, you know, an influence on pop culture throughout the ages, has really found a connection with, you know, the animation world.
Absolutely. I mean, my you know, influences of guitar and everything else, I mean, it's so high energy. There's, you know, so much passion behind it. I mean, I think that's one of the things that goes hand in hand. I mean, when an animator sits down to create a cartoon or whatever, I mean, that takes a certain level of passion, just as the same as it takes a musician to get up on stage. I mean, here you are, you're using an animated character to portray a certain ideal or tell a story, and so much of music, you know, tells that same story, and you know, the combination of the two worlds together, it just creates an awesome ambiance that I mean looking at the film, the 1981 film Heavy Metal, I mean, I went back and watched that the other day, and it's just awesome to see all this stuff come together and just jive so well.
Yeah, I mean, there's been so many properties that have been, you know, influenced by music, not only just having badass soundtracks, but if you go to, say, the Japan side of things, you know, with anime, there are so many like properties that, you know, the composers are almost as famous as the, you know, actors, like, you know, Cowboy Bebop, Ghost in the Shell, all that stuff done by Yoko Kanno. I mean, some of her, like I said, I think I have like all, she's like put out like six or seven albums based on Cowboy Bebop, and I think I have like all of them on my iPod, because like I said, her music style is just, you know, like that punk rock aesthetic goes great with those, you know, the visual storytelling media that, it just, like I said, I don't think those properties would have been as good without the, you know, badass theme songs and scoring that you get.
Oh yeah, I mean, the score and, you know, so many films and you know, animation in general, I mean, it's what makes it. I mean, not really so much of an animated film, but I mean, that's one of the reasons that Guardians of the Galaxy, I feel like, was so successful, is that badass soundtrack. I mean, yeah, you know, that's kind of getting out in the weeds a little bit, but, you know, that's a prime example that, you know, it's a throwback, and, you know, without that score, the movie wouldn't have had that level of energy.
Yeah, I have a theory that, like, all cartoonists want to be rock stars, and all rock stars want to be cartoonists at some point, because, you know, going, you know, the other way with, instead of, you know, music influencing animation, how many great music videos have we seen that are, you know, animated instead of a live action video.
Yeah, I mean, we'll talk about it a bit more in detail, but I mean, Pink Floyd's a prime example of that, you know, with the whole animated The Wall thing, and you know, so many other bands too. I mean, you know, getting in a little bit more modern times, we'll talk a little bit about Death Clock and the Metalocalypse TV show, and you know, I mean, you go and see those guys in band, and yeah, there's a physical band forming, but they have the animation playing in the background, and you know, as the scenes change, the band steps off stage, and you know, you're literally watching a live action cartoon at that point. So it's really awesome.
Yeah, let's start with one of probably the biggest music influenced films that I remember. Anyway, Heavy Metal from 1981, and which was based off of Heavy Metal magazine, which was a dark fantasy, sci-fi, erotica comic nearly that, you know, came out six times a year, and I believe it's still in production now. But you know, they put together a movie based off of some of the short stories from the book, and it's, you know, they piece it together with this, there's this whole over connecting arc that connects all these segments with this, the Loch Nahr, which is this orb who describes itself as the sum of all evils, and it's affected, you know, through time and space, and you know, causes destruction wherever it goes. Well, it appears this girl and is like, let me show you how I, because you know, all bad guys have to tell their master plan before they kill the hero. He's like, I'm going to kill you because in the future you could kill me, but I'm going to show you how I've destroyed the world. And you know, goes into all these little skits of people who have had encounters with the Loch Nahr. But like I said, with a name like Heavy Metal, you got to have the music to back it up, and there was so many. I mean, this movie's soundtrack was a collection of who's who of late 70s, early 80s metal bands. I mean, you had Blue Oyster Cult, Don Fager, Stevie Nicks, Journey, Grand Funk Railroad, Cheap Trick, Nazareth, Sammy Hagar, Black Sabbath, and even Devo in this movie.
And I mean, that's the cool thing. I mean, you know, you look over at the record crate, and I still got so many of these, you know, bands' albums that I've collected throughout the years and everything. You know, not being born into the mid 80s, you know, I miss this era, but, you know, I've got a very old soul, and, you know, my musician background and everything else. I mean, these bands, I mean, they're still influencing people to this day. I mean, these, you know, they're going to be timeless, they're going to carry on a legacy. And, you know, it's funny with all of the pop culture and everything else, and the way the music industry is today, it's funny watching people gravitate back to a lot of these older bands and stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, this just recently got a Blu-ray release back in 2011, I believe. And like I said, it was an anthology movie, like I said, with all the little short stories pieced together, which we don't really see that used much anymore, but that was big in the 70s and 80s. And it's, you know, directed by Gerald Potterton, but was produced by Ivan Reitman, which you may remember for a little movie called Ghostbusters.
Yes. And that's the thing, too. Like, you know, away from some of the main segments, we talked about this earlier. You know, if you listen to some of the subtlety background music a lot of times, like, it almost has that Ghostbusters soundtrack musical style to it.
Yeah, because the score was done by, I believe, the Philharmonic Orchestra, and you know, I guess Reitman has used them on a lot of things. And yeah, some of those non-rock song, you know, just background music, like I think he pretty much used again or used a version of, because they're some of the quieter moments definitely sounds like some of the score from Ghostbusters.
And I think Metalocalypse kind of got that, because they use the London Philharmonic Orchestra in a couple of their episodes. And, you know, once again, kind of all chaos, the world ending and everything's going to destruction. I mean, just because that's how it works in metal.
Yeah, and like I said, this movie was, like, huge when it came out. I mean, they made it for $9 million, it made $20 million, so it definitely made a profit. And it was only the sixth movie to be presented in Dolby Surround sound. So, yeah, they definitely, like I said, you're going to make a movie called Heavy Metal with a badass soundtrack, you got to have the sound technology to back it up.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a huge audiophile, so you know, if something is of shit quality, unfortunately, a lot of times I can't get past it, no matter how good the music may be or whatever. If it, you know, sounds like crap, I'm not going to listen.
Yeah, and we're both, you know, too young to have seen this when it came out. You weren't born yet, and I was like two. But
I mean, you might have saw it. I mean, were your parents old school metalheads?
Yeah, my parents were
heads?
Like, you know, old rockers, so that's maybe where I originally saw it. But yeah, it's definitely not a kid's cartoon, say the least.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it definitely has a lot of nudity, sex, violence, and drug use.
I was waiting on, you know, I had it playing on the TV in the bedroom. I was waiting on Rachel to walk in and be like, what the fuck are you watching? Some kind of adult hentai or some shit? Like, minus the tentacles?
Yeah, it's definitely of the 80s with all the someone gets naked just about every skit.
Yeah, you're guaranteed to see some awesome hairdos both above and below the belt.
Yeah. And like I said, the voice acting too, I mean, it featured John Candy in just about, I think, every one of the skits. But Eugene Levy, you know, Harold Ramis, like, you know, all these guys that you see working again and again with Ivan Reitman, you know, they were, because this came out the same year as Stripes. So yeah, I mean, you see a lot of those guys that he frequently used in his movies doing the voice acting. And I say it's some of my, I believe I first found this movie back when, you know, there was Blockbuster Videos, and they actually had an anime section, and this, you know, was in the anime, you know, because it definitely couldn't put it in the cartoon section where all the kids stuff. So
man, I don't even remember Blockbuster having an anime section, at least not the ones it may have been there, but
yeah,
I don't know. I was going to Blockbuster more so for video games and the latest like horror films for the most part, but
yeah, but before Netflix and the internet, yeah, that's where
before everything became digital.
Get my anime and stuff, and yeah, just the cover of it of this like badass warrior woman flying on this, you know,
I mean, it looks like
bird thing with a sword. I'm like, and it's called heavy metal. I'm like, I gotta check this out.
Take away everything, and I could definitely see this being on the front cover of a Judas Priest album.
Yeah, it definitely had that, you know, album cover look to it. And like I said, being a teenager at the time, you know, picking this up, and I was like, hey, there's boobs everywhere. Boobs and heavy metal. This is awesome.
Cartoon boobs, man.
Do you have any, like, you know, particular segments in that movie that that you enjoyed?
I think probably one of my favorites was, and, you know, I've only seen this film a couple of times, so the characters' names are vague. Anyway, the dude's in his car. He's, you know, basically rescued the girl after, you know, her father's been killed and everything. And this girl's just like, you know, you can have whatever you want from me, you know, just protect me type deal. And, you know, turns out the chick just like, you know, kind of goes haywire and is trying to screw the guy over. And, you know, the fact that his taxi cab, he's just got a button that he presses, and yeah, it's like laser beam, instant incineration.
Yeah, it's
he's
one of the very first segments, too. It's and it's very film noir because it's narrated by the protagonist. And it's set in New York 2031. And he's this grizzled old cabbie who ends up getting into this crime story because this girl has her father or whatever is an archaeologist has discovered the Loch Nahr, and some gangster is trying to take it from her. And yeah, like I said, it's like I said, very film noir. Like, that's one thing. Each segment is, like, you know, done by different artists and different.
I mean, it almost had like that post apocalyptic feel to it. And that's, I guess that's one of the things. I mean, you see the cabbie, it's got, you know, freaking armor plating and everything else yeah. on it. And you
kind of reminds me of Bruce Willis's character from The Fifth Element.
Yes.
it's very reminiscent of that.
And I think that may be why I liked it so much, is that I was like, all right, this very well could be a Bruce Willis.
Yeah. If they did live-action heavy metal, it would pretty much be Bruce Willis's character from The Fifth Element.
So same question right back at you. Which was your favorite of the anthology?
Like, so that was probably one of my favorite. The one that I always remember is the... and I can't remember the title of this segment, but it's toward the end of it, where these aliens try to abduct this guy, and it turns out to be like a malfunctioning cyborg, but they accidentally kidnap this you know, human lady, and the robot, like, you know, hooks up with the human girl. But the two pilots of the ship, which is Harold Ramis and Eugene Levy, are these two stoned aliens, and they pull out this giant bag of plutonium Nyborg, which is looks like space coke, and they have this like machine that looks almost like the thing you use to paint the chalk lines on a football field, and it's put out these giant lines of like coke and like snort it all and just go through space like tripping balls. Yes. And they go. They tried to land on the space station, and the other guy's like, "You okay to land, man?" And he's like, "Oh, it's all good. The trick to flying stoned is, you know, your perspective is fucked, right? So you just gotta let your hands worth control like you're sober." And then, of course, they crash into the space station.
Yeah, I think that was the so beautiful and so dangerous segment. Because that one really stood out in mind. Yeah, I forgot. Because I saw the, essentially the space coke, and instantly, you know, I kind of had to throw back to Dr. Roxo and his love for cocaine.
Harry Canyon is the name of the taxi driver segment, which Harry Canyon, that could be something else they were talking about in these movies. And also B-17, too. That was another one that one always creeped me out as a kid, because it's, the Lochnar is like, I have affected wars throughout history and stuff, and it all of a sudden shows them in World War II, and there's this plane battle with this B-52, these big bombers, and then the Lochnar crashes into the ship.
Introduction of the freaking zombies was another thing.
Yeah, and brings the dead crew to life, and it turns into a little zombie thing, and that's probably one of the creepiest of all the different series, and that one also had the. I believe that's where the how was it? Take a Ride on Heavy Metal song comes into, which is kind of the theme of the. That's the song they use in a lot of the advertisements and stuff, and that's probably one of my favorite songs on the soundtrack.
Yeah, another one that stood out was the Neverwhere Land, just because they used the freaking Pink Floyd the intro to the song Time.
Yeah,
so you just have that playing throughout the. That segment, and I thought that was awesome. I kept waiting. I was like, it's going to go on. But no, it's just on a loop. So you only get that little teaser of the song, and you're like, damn it.
Yeah, because I mean, that one, there's this kid who finds the orb, and it gets struck by lightning and takes him to this other world where on Earth he's a nerdy kid. But when he gets there, he's this big, burly, warrior and becomes the hero because everyone's trying to sacrifice this girl to the creature they're trying to summon is called Uthulek, which is Cthulhu backwards.
And as we look around at all the Cthulhu artwork I have hanging on my wall, I mean, that's just a little something after, my fancy.
Oh, yeah, but yeah, was it the Sammy Hagar song, too, in their heavy metal? That's another great song on the soundtrack. So the movie's worth watching just for the soundtrack alone, even if you don't get into the the stories of it.
So was there a DVD release of this film that you know of? I know that it was on VHS. I was just kind of looking through my notes here, and
yeah,
they were talking about some extended scenes and stuff that...
Yeah, I'm not... Because there's supposed to be a scene... Because there's one of the scenes, which is Captain Stern. There's supposed to be a scene that connected the Den thing to the Captain Stern one, but that got cut. Which was later released on the Blu-ray and DVD or VHS versions. But, there was such a... Since, like I said, the soundtrack had so many bands on it, it was hard to get... They had problems arguing with the rights as far as, video release. So it took 15 years before it ever got a video release. So, it came out in 81, didn't get a VHS release until 96. And then eventually, like I said, we got the Blu-ray edition in 2011, but I don't know if it ever came out on just standard DVD or not.
Well, if it's on Blu-ray, I need to make it a point to try to find a copy quick to the Amazon or somewhere.
Yeah, I think when it first came out, it was a Best Buy exclusive, but then it got a wider release after that. But I think that's where I've seen it recently, was at Best Buy.
Yeah, I'd love to see it, especially if they remastered or, did anything, just to see. Oftentimes there's so many little hidden Easter eggs in these types of films that I'd love to go and check it out.
Yeah, I'd like to see some of the cut scenes behind the scenes stuff if it's on there.
Oh, that would be an absolute riot to watch.
Yeah, do yourself a favor. Download it, go buy it, whatever. Check it out. Take a flashback. I mean, even the animation, really, it's that older style animation, but it holds up. It still looks pretty good.
I actually find myself, I prefer the older style of animation. I was going back watching some old school Hanna-Barbera stuff and everything else. And, that's one reason that it's, you know, outside of like the Vampire Hunter D's, the Cowboy Bebops, and, you know, some of the other, you know, Japanese animation films, a lot of times it's really hard for me to get into it. I mean, I was sitting around finding myself playing Street Fighter, one of the newer versions, and the animation just looked too crisp, too clean. It didn't have the same feel, and I put it down, and I won't play it again, you know, for that reason. So I'm of the old school mindset. Yeah, I like the old animation style.
Yeah, and even some of this stuff was done with rotoscoping, where they film a live actor and then trace it into the animation cells. So the B-17 segment was done with, you know, model planes that they rotoscoped in to the animation. So there's like almost a little bit of, you know, level of realism to that one section. And even some of the like the final segment about the hero, the Tarnak. The actress that played, there was, you know, that was actually based on an actress that they rotoscoped in. So that was, like, you know, based on a real person.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, this, you know, movie actually went on, we had a sequel come out, Heavy Metal 2000. And I hadn't had an opportunity to see this yet. But apparently this was a direct-to-video release. And
yeah, it was. It just didn't, I never saw it because I didn't hear good things about it. It was it in the same vein as the original Heavy Metal? Because instead of being an anthology, it was one single story about this one character through the whole thing. And, you know, and it wasn't based off stories from the magazine. It just kind of took the Heavy Metal name.
Interesting. Yeah, and I was just looking here. So apparently it even went on to spawn a video game. So
yeah, it's like Heavy Metal Frack or Fack 3, yeah, or something like that.
So I'd be curious just to go and check it out. I'm like you, you know, I definitely don't hear the praises and everything that I did from the original film. So, but
yeah, because I mean, this,
you know, oftentimes that's what happens, you know, when you have a successful something and, you know, another person tries to create a, you know, something similar and it just loses that aspect. But I mean, I'm looking here, and there's a lot more bands. I mean, you had everybody from ICP and Twisted going from...
really?
Yeah.
I'm not watching it.
I mean, it had Pantera, Monster Magnet. I mean...
All right, maybe it's worth seeing
them. You know, yeah, so...
Oh, yeah, and I mean, this movie, with that whole problem of them not being able to get it out on video, it really became a huge, like, cult film too, and played in a lot of, like, midnight theaters, almost like Rocky Horror Picture Show did.
Yeah, which Rocky Horror Picture Show just had a 40th anniversary. So there's that.
We're old.
Which, you know what, I mean, not necessarily animated, but I mean, the soundtrack to that film, I mean, dude, the Time Warp, like, I don't, pretty much every con you go to, like, even some of your big dance clubs, I mean, that song still gets, you know, played quite a bit. I mean, I think it's probably one of the first dances that most people learn, and, you know, they learn the dance, and they think it's so innocent until they see the film.
And, like I said, that led into other animated movies. For example, Pink Floyd, The Wall, came out a year later, and was the 7th animated movie to be released in Dolby Digital.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, dude, the Wall vinyl records, the DVDs, I mean, The Wall has a special place in my heart that, you know, no other band's going to be able to fill that place.
It's been a long time since I've seen it, but basically, I mean, it's, yeah, almost a, whatever, 2-hour sound or music video for the album. I mean, it's pretty much all the songs from the album are pretty much included in the movie.
Yeah, I think the big thing for The Wall for me is that whole psychological horror aspect of things. I mean, it's so trippy. It's, you know, it's pretty dark. I mean,
yeah,
but
it's like, yeah,
you know, you don't have the blaring guitars and everything, but, you know, just the effects. I mean, I oftentimes hear a lot of the synthesized sounds and everything else that haunted houses use, and, you know, I attribute a lot of that stuff directly to, you know, Pink Floyd. You know, they were one of the people that use that aspect in the storytelling and everything, and I mean,
and they still do the, like, Pink Floyd laser show, you know, a couple times a year. And I mean, this movie really documented, like, the protagonist, which was you know, named Pink, Floyd Pink Pinkerton, just kind of who is a rock star, and just kind of documents his descent into madness, where he just goes, like, batshit crazy. And, you know, it could be a real story to some rockers.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'd almost take it to almost like a Batman aspect. I mean, you know, he's driven to insanity by the death of his father, and, you know, the depression and everything else starts setting in, and, you know, it's just kind of that whole downward spiral, if you will. Not to necessarily tout Nine Inch Nails, but that's there.
Oh.
But, you know, the whole imagery and the sound and everything else, I mean, that's, you know, the emotion and everything that it creates, I mean, it does something to the soul. I mean, Pink Floyd's one of those bands, you sit around and, you know, I mean, a lot of people will say, oh, you got to do the Dark Side of the Rainbow, the whole, you know, Pink Floyd, Wizard of Oz, yeah. You know, mashup. But you know what? There's been many times that, you know, I've sat down not being, you know, under the influence of anything, just with my thoughts and Pink Floyd playing in the background. And that's almost like a deprivation chamber experience, I would think. I mean, it just does something to your psyche, and it takes you to a place that other band's taken me.
Another Brick in the Wall still gets radio play today. I mean, that's, you know, that came out of this this album. And it, like I said, it's still, I've even heard a few covers of that song, and it, like I said, it's still quite popular today.
Absolutely. So, yeah, huge throw to Pink Floyd.
And that kind of leads us into, you know, I've seen other, where, like I said, rock and roll has always influenced animation. Just about every, like I said, we're going to talk about fictional bands here in a second, but there's a lot of cartoons and stuff that, you know, at least for an episode or two, will have some kind of, like, rock band type influence.
Not necessarily a band, but, dude, think about Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Yeah, like I said, we're going to get into that in a second, talking about fictional bands, but I'm talking about, like I said, there's, like, you know, episodes of Scooby-Doo, where it's like, I mean, just recently we had Scooby-Doo meets Kiss.
Yes.
Or Scooby-Doo meets the Monkees, or whatever. And even, you know, Scooby-Doo always had that musical montage video in it, you know, where it's like there was, like, you know, a reason to rock out, at least, you know, especially in the older, you know, 60s, 70s versions of Scooby-Doo, there's always, like, a musical interlude. And I remember even going back to the original Ghostbusters, the real Ghostbusters animated series, I remember one episode where they went to this town that was haunted by a band that would play, and every time it would play, it would kind of pull the town into old-timey town. So to be able to capture these ghosts that kept reverting everything back to the past, the Ghostbusters put together a band and had, like, a battle of the bands with the ghosts. And as they're kind of fighting over control, it keeps going from, like, different time areas. Like, the ghost keeps trying to take them back to, like, Victorian big band. And it's going from, like, that to, like, jazz to, like, modern 80s hair metal. And just, like, back and forth through all these time periods. And the song is changing as the battle goes on. And that's probably one of my favorite episodes.
You're telling a story, and my whole time I'm hearing Charlie Daniels, The Devil Went Down to Georgia.
Pretty much. That's a good version of that. So yeah, like I said, the you know, musicians are always, you know, showing up in one. I mean, even like I said, the last Call of Duty game, you know, had Avenged Sevenfold on it, and even has, like, an animated music video at the end of the game once you beat it, featuring the band and characters from the game playing together.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I mean, I love the stories that the animation tells. I love the story that the music tells. I mean, you know, we've talked a lot about metal and stuff of that nature, but, I mean, that's one of the big backbones of, you know, the whole blues music scene, too. I mean, the whole making the deal with the devil and the crossroads between, you know, success and fame, you know, versus, you know, selling your soul and what you stand for as an individual, so...
And you know, off air, we talk about Beavis and Butthead. I mean, Beavis and Butthead is, you know, directly influenced by music, because that was, like, you know, there was always the cartoon aspects, but between the skits, there was always just them sitting on the couch making fun of music videos.
And then you have Beavis and Butthead Do America, and, you know, then they actually get the concert in hell as they're descending on their acid trip.
Yeah, which that, you know, segment there, I think, was all done by Rob Zombie.
Yes.
And that's another one who's always been influenced by animation, because, I mean, a lot of the old if not Rob Zombie, the White Zombie videos, you know, featured, you know, heavily on the almost that 60s whatever Rat Fink style animation.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons I loved, you know, White Zombie so much is I've always just been a fan of, you know, old school rat rods and, you know, the pinup tattoos and everything else. So, yeah.
All right. So let's get into the birth of the fictional band, if you will. like I said, you know, there's not only been cartoons influenced by music, but there's been, like, bands that have come out of cartoons themselves. The very first animated fictional band was Alvin and the Chipmunks back in 1958. Yeah, and if you don't remember from watching some of the old original stuff, they were a band, and Dave Seville, who was their, you know, adoptive father, was also like the manager of the band. And even like every Christmas, you still hear those damn jingle bells and whatever the Chipmunk Christmas album that came out way back then still gets radio play like every single year. I don't go into a store without hearing fucking Chipmunk's Christmas album playing somewhere.
I mean, I can remember, you know, probably one of my first forays into hip hop as a kid was Alvin and the Chipmunks doing some gangster rap.
Yeah, because they got a, you know, they got a reboot like in the 90s and had like a more modern version of Alvin and the Chipmunks. But yeah, that original stuff that. They were a band.
And I think it's ingenious, too, that, I mean, you know, the Chipmunks were created just by speeding up a soundtrack to give it that high-pitched sound quality.
Yeah, Ross Bagdasarod was the, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, was the originator of the Alvin and the Chipmunks, and he did all the singing, just sped up his voice to do the, you know, the Chipmunks.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, it earned 2 Grammy rewards for engineering, so I'd say that's a success.
And I say even animated bands have made, you know, the charts. One of the, you know, next animated bands in the 60s was the Archies, based on the old Archie comic book. So when that series came out back in 69, which is kind of funny because if you've ever heard the song Sugar Sugar, that's from the Archies. Yes. And apparently the creator of that was a manager for the Monkees, and he wanted them to do that song, and they didn't like it. So he's like, well, screw this. I'm going to get a band that I have absolute control over, and created the Archies. And then, that, like I said, that's like one of the first songs to hit the charts from a fictional rock group. And like I said, it still gets airplay today.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, went on and, you know, you had Josie and the Pussycats. I mean, a lot of other, you know, great bands. I mean,
even the Muppet Show.
The Muppets, yeah. I mean,
Dr. Mayhem and the what was the name of the rock band? Yeah, look that up, because I'm going to hate myself for not remembering. I know Electric, is it Electric Mayhem or... but yeah, that, I mean, and they rocked pretty hard on the old Muppet Show.
Yeah, Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem.
There we go. I got it backward. Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem with Animal is the Drummer.
I mean, I wonder if that's where Chuck E. Cheese kind of had the idea of, hey, we're going to give this giant rat a band, and he's going to be the mascot of the company. And
yeah. Oh, yeah, because back before it was that before it became Chuck E. Cheese, it was Circus Pizza, and they had a animatronic rock band. And like I said, then eventually, like I said, they just shortened it to Chuck E. Cheese and made him like the mascot. But yeah. Back in the day, going to those original shows, it was this whole animatronic rock band that would play while you eat pizza.
Which, as a kid, was awesome. As an adult, it doesn't really hold the same meaning that it once did.
Yeah, but like I said, with the Archies, and then, you know, probably next up would be Josie and the Pussycats in the 70s, that kind of kicked off this whole era of them taking that proven formula of kids hunting down monsters from Scooby-Doo, and then putting it around a band. I mean, Josie and the Pussycats came out, and like I said, the Muppet Show, and then there was like a bunch of the, I can't even remember now, like Chattanooga Cats, The Impossible, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kids. Yes. And the one that I actually remember was Jabberjaw, because like I said, back in the 80s growing up, they'd always play those like 70s cartoons on Saturday morning cartoons, and basically, it was Scooby-Doo, but instead of a dog, it was a shark. And the shark was the drummer of the band.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's such an awesome time. I mean, you know, I kind of miss it, you know. I mean, that's the thing. You go to a rock show and, you know, you're not just looking for a band to perform. You're looking for, you know, an experience. And I think a lot of bands miss that, you know, today.
Especially looking at Josie and the Pussycats. That's so close to a freaking Scooby-Doo. Because, I mean, they're in a band. I mean, they're in a van. And, you know, instead of a dog, there's a cat in the group. But kids solving crimes riding around in a band. And that was a good, you know, set up for them solving crimes is, hey, you're on a band, you're in a different town every night, you know, it's plausible that you come across these mysteries and bad guys and such.
So we're gonna start a band, and we're just gonna start doing ghost hunting.
There you go.
We're gonna find just haunted venues or, you know, abandoned shacks and things that have a haunted story, and that's gonna be our excuse. Hey, we're putting on a concert, but then we're gonna actually see what evil dwells here.
And even some of the actors, and you can see the, when you look at some of these other groups, you can see the Scooby-Doo characters. Like I said, in the Josie and the Pussycats, their like manager and their roadie looked and sounded a lot like Fred and Shaggy. Especially their like tech guy, but he was like even a more like hipster version of Shaggy. And then, like,
hey,
said,
no need to reinvent the wheel.
You know, Jabberjaws, of course. You know, Jabberjaws was he was the scaredy cat shark instead of the scaredy cat dog. But yeah, there were so many crossovers, and I think they even had a Josie and the Pussycats and Scooby-Doo at one point. So yeah, it was weird seeing those characters together.
Absolutely. But I mean, it just, you know, in a way it was weird, but at the same time, like, it kind of felt right at that time frame, you know? I mean, it didn't seem out of place.
Yeah, I mean, the 60s and 70s was definitely a rock and roll era. I mean, there's so many shows and stuff that was influenced, you know, by music and vice versa. I mean, that was definitely a time where you can't just download anything you wanted. You know, music had to be experienced wherever you can get it. And, you know, Saturday morning cartoons was one of the spots to get it.
Definitely.
And then, you know, that stuff kind of rebooted in the 80s when we got Jim and the Holograms.
Yes. Oh, Jim and the Holograms.
Yep. In the time of G.I. Joe and Transformers, we had a song about a show about a girl band also fighting crime at some point in some of the episodes. which they're supposed to be doing a live-action movie of that here pretty soon. Which we already had a live-action Josie and the Pussycats, which I never saw. But yeah, Jim and the Holograms is making a comeback.
Yeah, I'm just looking here.
Which is basically Barbie if she had a band.
Yeah, I mean, it's scheduled for release on October 23rd of 2015. So, very soon.
Which, I think even in that, like, the band that they were always competing against, the Misfits, was probably, I thought, better than Jim and the Holograms. They were more of the punk rock in that 80s, you know, hair metal sound. Yeah, I enjoyed them more than I did the main band.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. It was funny because talking about the Misfits, I mean, I just had to break out my Misfit shirt for this this episode. It just felt right. But yeah, I mean, I like the whole horror punk aspect of the Misfits that they brought to the show.
And speaking of horror, do you remember Groovy and the Ghoulies?
Groovy and the...
It was a rock band that consisted of Frankenstein, Dracula, and the Wolfman, and the Mummy.
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny, because they were all very capable musicians.
Yeah. Yeah, and they always had, like, they would always be playing with, like, other horror band, like the Rolling Headstones and the Mummies and the Puppies, yeah, instead of the Mamas and the Puppets.
That's awesome.
That was another, like, weird, yeah, Saturday morning cartoon. And, like, even today, I mean, like, South Park had Timmy and the Lords of the Underworld.
Yep. And, I mean, hell, you know, talking about South Park, I mean, even Griffin and Quagmire had a little music endeavor on Family Guy.
Or even, like, said some of the stuff from when we were growing up, like Daria. There was always Mystical Spiral, which was the freaking emo goth the punk band that, that showed up in a few episodes.
Yeah, I never really could. Daria was a bit too emo for my taste. I mean, it didn't even feel goth to me. I was just like, man, these people are just pathetic. Like, and looking back on it, I'm like, damn, I was one of those people. No wonder I was miserable. I was miserable with myself.
Or the beats from Doug with Killer Tofu.
Yeah, and I mean, it's just awesome, you know. I mean, hell, The Simpsons, you know, I think Marge tried to do something at one point on some of their episodes. And
I think Homer had a band at one point. And even... and then we have stuff like the Gorillas, which was never a cartoon, but it was a band that was animated. You know, I've never actually seen the artists behind the Gorillas. They always appear as themselves, the cartoon, when you see them. I mean, they've even been on episodes of MTV Cribs with their fictional animated house.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean... I don't know, man. The Gorillaz, they're another band that, you know, really hold a special place in my heart, you know, especially with the whole Clint Eastwood thing. And, yeah, that's a throwback to my early high school years.
And that brings us to probably your favorite of the fictional animated bands. You want to give that intro there?
Yeah, so I think you're probably going to lead in, you know, with a little band called Death Clock from the show Metalocalypse.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably the most modern interpretation of the animated band. But, I mean, Metalocalypse was kind of revolutionary on the way they did things because they took the music as seriously as the cartoon. I mean, it's all about the world's greatest death metal band.
Yeah, I mean, and the animation aspect of things, the way they did the show, and, I mean, you know, I watched interviews with Brandon Small and stuff of that nature, and, you know, that's them actually, like, you know, if you could slow it down and actually transpose that, they're actually playing instruments. And,
yeah,
you know,
they spent a lot of time on the animation because they're using real instruments. I mean, the show was sponsored by, you know, actual... musical.
Oh, yeah.
I'm trying to bring up the, yeah, Gibson guitar,
yeah, I mean,
Dunlap
guitars,
manufacturing,
EMG
Line
pickups.
6, Marshall amplifiers, Gibson, EMG, and like I said, so they were using real equipment, and they were actually animated characters are actually playing instruments in the show. I mean, if you like pay close attention, it's a functional guitar, and they're playing the actual notes that they're playing in the songs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they went on to headline with Mastodon in their tour back in 2009. And, you know, we had the opportunity to see Death Clock at Center Stage when they were in Atlanta. And, you know, kind of out in the weeds, but to put it in perspective, I mean, you know, I've been to Marilyn Manson concerts. I've been to Slayer concerts. A lot of these, like, big concerts and stuff that are people like, oh my God, you know, that's... You know, how did you survive? I mean, you know, people talk about how brutal and violent those types of concerts and stuff are and the over-the-top nature. But, dude, being in a mosh pit at the Death Clock concert was brutal than any mosh pit I've been in at a Slayer or Manson concert.
Yeah, I mean, I went to when the show first came out, they did, like, a free tour. Like, you know, the first so many people in line got tickets. And I went to see that, and it was awesome how they did it because the band was... you know, on stage, but they were blacked out. You could see there was a band up there, but you couldn't really see them, and they had this big movie screen above the stage, and, you know, so the band is playing on the screen, and then the real band is playing on the stage, but you can't see them because they're all kind of, like, backlit, and like I said, there's, like, was, like, cuts from the show and stuff, and a little animated movie that went along with
the
concert.
Yeah, I mean, the whole concert was anime, and that was the cool aspect of it, too, is, you know, it was almost like you were watching a live filming of a Metalocalypse, you know.
Yeah, and like
show.
The final like encore songs, they brought the lights up so you could finally see the band behind the band. But I mean, they rocked just as hard as they did on the cartoon.
Yeah, I mean, it was truly an awesome experience. And in fact, that's probably one of the most memorable concerts that I can remember, you know, not just being a fan of death metal. And, you know, I think the other reason that the Metalocalypse TV series, you know, played so well is, I mean, you know, at being a metalhead, you know, you're trying to be dark, you're trying to be brutal. And, you know, this entire show is just making fun of all of that stuff. I mean,
you know, so many metalheads take this stuff like way too seriously. And it kind of like made fun of that, but also honored it at the same time. Without,
yes.
They made fun of them taking themselves too seriously.
I just love, you know, like one of the beginning of seasons. I mean, just kind of put it in perspective. Like, they walk into a grocery store and they're so out of touch with reality. You know, they're just like, whoa, what's this place?
This like food library?
This is food's libraries. Like, they're so dumb and washed out, but, you know, they're so... they don't even realize how successful they are. I mean,
yeah. And then I was like, freaking Pickles, the drummer, his cart is full of alcohol. He's like, alcohol's food, right?
Yes. Oh, man. Yeah. And I mean, there's so many great humorous moments.
And Murderface, the typical like bass player that hates himself.
Yeah. And you even had, you know, Murderface, you know, I mean, yeah, the bass player, by and large, unless you're a Flea or somebody of that nature, you know, really gets discredited from the band. But we did the science article that proves that, you know, bass is actually a very important part of music. Without the bass there, it doesn't carry the same rhythm, have the same feel and everything.
It's going to go back to my original band, Planet Pit.
Yeah. Yeah, he's so washed out, you know, out of shape and everything else. You know, he's getting on the cover of Time magazine. He's like, oh, God, I'm fat.
I could be a murder face for Dragon Con.
Yes.
Get you a wig. You can be Squizguard. but, yeah, I mean, this band is like, it spawned, what, 3-4 albums that are, you know, actually, I think charted.
They made a top 200 with, you know, I think their first album.
Yeah, I've got the first Death album. I haven't picked up the other two. I need to get those. But, I mean, even, you know, the guitar have been really, like, they released a version of, the Death Clock Thunder Horse Explorer guitar was actually released by Gibson. And then became, you know, and then, like, so that was the guitar that Squizguard would always use on the show. So, and like I said, they've been in Guitar Hero, and they've even showed up in like a Soundgarden music video, Black Rain. And like I said, they've, for a fictional band, they've, you know, had influences on all these other things. And even like the voice acting, I mean, Mark Hamill was on the show. Yeah. Like so many like famous people did voices and stuff for the show.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know, you know, just the sheer animation fact, and, you know, to being a musician, I can appreciate, you know, the level of effort, the time, and everything else that these guys put into it. I mean, you don't do something, you know, to that magnitude without having your heart invested in it. And for me, that's what music and, you know, I would say anybody doing animation or anything, that's what it takes, is it takes that level of heart, you know, to make folks feel whatever you're trying to portray, either in the animation, in the music, whatever. And at the end of the day, that's what truly makes things great.
Yeah, and just the, like I said, the whatever, Nathan Explosion, Squizguard, Toki Wartooth.
Not a Murderface. Bumblebee. William, Murderface.
And Pickles, the drummer.
Yeah, I think that even went on. I think there is actually, you know, somebody has made a brand of the Duncan Hills coffee, you know, at this point.
Scream for the cream.
Yeah.
Oh, and
which, used out of context, will get you in trouble every time.
Yeah, just ask Mike. and also, I'm pretty sure their manager is an animated version of Coulson from Agent Shields.
Oh yeah, dude! Like,
their manager is just such a badass.
As the seasons progress, yes, he definitely
looks like Coulson.
Yeah, I almost wonder, like, if they didn't draw up, like, oh yeah, Coulson, he's gonna be this guy.
Yeah,
he's part ninja. He's, you know, freaking trained in all these combat skills, but at the same time, he's just like, you know, trying to manage these band, and, you know, put it in also another perspective, the fact too that, you know, the band tries to embezzle from themselves.
It's like, someone's stealing from you, and they're like, oh yeah, it's us.
Yeah.
I mean, McDowell was on there, did, you know, several characters. Friggin', like I said, Mark Hamill did all kind of actors on the show, and pretty much all of the voices of the band, at least, and most of the music is done by Brendan Smalls.
Yeah,
you know, being a guitarist and animator, yeah, you know, he kind of put his two passions together into one project, and it really shows because he was so serious about the music and portraying the music correctly.
Yeah, that's one vocal style I would never be able to touch.
And, of course, my favorite character, Dr. Roxo, the rock and roll clown. Which is pretty much...
And he loves cocaine.
Yeah, it's a clown version of David Lee Roth. That's the best way to explain Dr. Roxo. I'm Dr. Roxo, the rock and roll clown, and I do cocaine. Seriously, I do a lot of cocaine.
Oh, yes. And, you know, I mean, he even goes on, he has his band.
Yeah,
you know,
there's so many, like, reoccurring versions of him, and at, like, one point he goes to, like, rehab and gets straight. I mean, it's just, he's, like, the epitome of, like, the washed-up 80s hair metal rocker.
I mean, I would almost think, you know, the movie Almost Famous probably alluded to some of that, you know, being on a rooftop, tripping balls, and I am a golden god. That's another great movie, just rock and roll in general.
All right, so is there any... What is your favorite music from an animation? Is there anything that, like, pops up, like, you know, other than... Like I said, we've talked a lot about Death Clock. What is your absolute... Like, is there any favorite thing that you always recall when it comes to animation and music combined?
You know, going back to South Park and Timmy and the Lords of the Underworld... Like, that to me is always going to have a special place. I don't know what it is, but something about that just, you know, I love it. You know, freaking, I playing on either Guitar Hero, Rock Band, whatever it is. I mean, that's probably one of my favorite songs to play. It's, like, one of the most impossible songs to play, which I think is also funny.
And the Lords of the... Oh, that's so ridiculous.
I don't know. The other one, I don't know about... This may be out in the weeds, so, you know, call me a dumbass or whatever, but, you know, Jack Black and his stuff in The Pick of Destiny. I mean, there's a lot of...
Well, Jack Black did a video game where he played a roadie.
Yeah.
And it was basically, like, you know, you fought monsters with his guitar through the whole thing. I can't remember the name of the game right hand, but speaking of South Park, I mean, there's so many. I mean, South Park kind of...
Yeah, the game was Brutal Legend.
Yeah, Brutal Legend. I mean, that had, like, a badass, like, rock and roll soundtrack, but, you know, going back to South Park, I mean, they had several albums get released. I mean, not only with Chef's songs, but they've had Master P on the show. They've had, like, all these different rock groups and people doing voices for the show that, yeah, so that one is, you know, also had a big musical influence.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I don't know. Is there one that really stands out to you?
I think for me, like, all the, to go back to the anime stuff, is, like, all the music from Cowboy Bebop. Like I said, I loved the stuff Yoko Kano was doing, Yoko Kano in the Seatbelt, which, you know, even though it was a Japanese thing, it had an English rock theme to it.
You just want blue hair and big eyes.
Dude, no, I want to be Spike Spiegel with the green hair and the Jericho 9mm flying around in my Swordfish 2.
Yes. Oh, so.
All right, what's your favorite Death Clock song?
Jeez. Louise, you dropped that on me now. Damn it. Let's see here. Birthday Death Day is a really good one. off one of their newer, just for the song title alone, I Ejaculate Fire. Like,
I mean, see a doctor about that.
Or maybe even, you know, Thunder Horse. I mean,
yeah, just I think Thunder Horse is probably my favorite song.
Blood Recruited.
Go Back to the Water, or where they would have raised the.
Yep, Go Into the Water. That was another good one. I mean, almost had that melodic metal feel to it. For me, I can pop in a Metalocalypse album, any of them, and it's one of the few that I will let play from start to finish without skipping.
Yeah, I need to download the other Death albums. I've just got the first one. So as we're kind of wrapping up here, any final thoughts on anime and our animation and rock and roll influences?
Yeah, keep doing it, folks. You know, I mean, it's two areas that I'm very passionate about. And, you know, it goes so hand in hand. Like I said, there's a lot of heart and feeling and everything. You do it right.
Yeah, one thing I forgot about, there was a second Ghostbusters cartoon that came out in like the 90s that the cartoon itself wasn't that good, but the theme song was like this metal version of the Ghostbusters theme song that was pretty badass. I mean, that opening theme was worth sitting through the show and just sit through that first theme, and then you can cut it off after that. What was that the other day we listened to where they mixed Ghostbusters with something else?
Oh, man, I don't remember what that was.
Was it Thunderstruck or?
You know, it was Ghostbusters and, let's see.
Yeah, we were listening to like this it was DJ Booty from Dragon Con, one of his playlists, and he had mixed Ghostbusters with a rock and roll song.
Yeah, it was called Thunderbusters.
Yeah, Thunderstruck with Ghostbusters, and that was actually damn good.
Oh yeah, we played that from start to finish, and we were both sitting there, you know, fist pumping the air with our devil horns and everything. You know, I think we even tried to resurrect Satan at one point. But
so what's your final thoughts on this cigar as we finish up here?
This cigar maintained its balance. You know, it was very flavorful. It was smooth. I mean, this was a very good smoke from start to finish. I can't say anything negative about this. I mean, the creaminess, you know, there was a hint of coffee and just a subtle, you know, spice.
Yeah, definitely pick up a lot of the coffee and spice in the beginning and more of the cream toward the end.
It was very, I mean, compared to, you know, a lot of the Lajeros and the spicier smokes, this is definitely one that, you know, you could sit down, you know, pair with a whiskey or something. It's not overly complex or overly, you know, one note just doesn't jump at you. So, you know, I want to pour some 21-year-old scotch in a glass and sit down with this smoke again and make an afternoon of it.
Yeah, it's definitely... it's not the strongest cigar. Like, it's definitely on the high end of medium. I mean, you're not getting like kicked in the face with the strength of it, but the flavor of it. It's very full flavored but with a kind of a smooth creamy finish. This is, like I said, this right now is kind of my go to cigar at the moment.
Absolutely. So, any final thoughts or anything for you, Joe, at this point?
No, I think we've about covered it. I guess we'll wrap this up and get on to Beer 30.
Stay tuned.
It's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
The Boozehounds return.
And welcome back. It's time for Beer 30. What are we drinking this week, Brad?
This week we are drinking Kentucky Old Fashioned Barrel Ale.
Yeah, this is from the same people that make Kentucky Bourbon Barrel Ale. This is kind of their interpretation of the Old Fashioned, which is a nice bourbon drink. It's brewed with cherries and orange peel, aged in oak bourbon barrels and bitters.
And anybody that knows about the Old Fashioned drink would know that, you know, that's essentially two fingers of whiskey, a bit of sugar, a couple dashes of bitters, and garnished with an orange. So pretty much all the ingredients can be found inside this bottle. But, you know, this is an interesting beer because it is actually quite boozier than some of the other beers. I mean, this thing does come in at a 10% ABV.
It's definitely different than their usual recipe.
But, you know, with the cherries, the orange peel, none of those flavors are distinct. Like, not one thing jumps out at me. I mean, it almost kind of seems a bit gimmicky, but, you know, I mean,
I don't know. Maybe you've just blown your taste buds out, because it does have a little bit of, I don't know, cherry notes to the aroma of it. And there's, you get a little bit of cherries on the front end, but then more of like a boozy, almost barley wine flavor.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely, this thing is drinking more like a barley wine to me. And I guess, you know, that's the orange peel and the cherries, you know. I mean, barley wines, typically you get those fruitier essences and things of that nature. So I can say this probably isn't my most favorite beer I've had. You know, it's certainly drinkable, but it's, I don't know, could just be that, you know, I've been up for a while and I'm having an off night, but, you know, it seems to be a bit heavy for me for some reason, which is weird because typically I like the fuller body beers and everything, but this one just isn't, you know, settling with me the way that some of the others have.
Yeah, it's like I said, it may be the fact that, you know, I'm comparing it to their previous versions I've had. Like I said, the Bourbon Barrel Ale and the Bourbon Barrel Stout. I love those beers, but, you know, they have that more of that bourbon aged character. But this one doesn't have as much as that bourbon kick that their other beers have. Like I said, it tastes more like a barley wine. It's definitely got, you know, a lot fruitier and lighter taste than some of their other beers.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would, for me, I think this beer needs a little bit of a bitterness to it. I mean, it's almost like you don't have any of that hop twang or anything to it, and I'm not an IPA fan, you know, so I'm certainly not a hop head, but, you know, it needs a bite or something, you know, to complete itself for me.
Yeah, because it tastes like a barley wine, but it doesn't taste like a great barley wine. It's just kind of a middle-of-the-road drinking beer. Like I said, I mean, it's not something I would drink for, like, you know, a special occasion, but this may be, like I said, you cut the grass, you need a beer, this will get the job done. Especially at 10%, you drink two of these, you're not going to care what it tastes like.
I mean, that may be the other thing, too, is, you know, maybe I just need the alcohol to hit me or something, and, you know, then, you know, I won't be as critical about the beer. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm not really trying to be a snob. I mean, you know, if you like beer, fucking drink beer. You don't need me to tell you what to drink.
Come on, Brad. Tell us what that's what the whole podcast for. We can tell people what to drink.
Sweet. Now we just need endorsements. I don't know.
Sponsored by NASCAR.
For me, I think I'm at like maybe a 3 or 3.25 on this beer.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I'm rating. It's about a 3.5. It's a decent beer, but it's not a great beer.
Yeah, and it. You know, I mean, there's just something that it's lacking that I just wish would jump out and, you know, grab my taste buds and, you know, I could change my perception a little bit, but it just hasn't happened yet.
Yeah, and like I said, even then, it may be the fact that I'm expecting more from Kentucky because of their other two beers have been just great beers, that this one's just kind of a little bit plain.
Well, I mean, it's... You know, I mean, very well could be the style. You know, if I judge this just from the standpoint of, oh yeah, this is an L, that's what you got. It's an L from that standpoint. But, you know, to call it the Old Fashioned Barrel L and, you know, the marketing behind it, I'm anticipating something a bit more that just isn't there.
I think the title confused, because if you don't realize that they're referring to the old fashioned and you're expecting old fashioned barrel ale, not an old fashioned in a bottle, then it kind of screws up your interpretation.
But you know what? Give me my fucking whiskey. All right. You know, I mean, then, all right, then we can rock and roll.
let's just go make some old fashions. We got some bourbon in the fridge. We'll just, instead of going to the beer, we'll just go ahead and just go straight to the regular old fashioned.
And I'm okay with that. So,
all right, give it a try. Tell us what you think. You know, call us assholes if you disagree with us.
Call us assholes anyway. It'll be the truth.
All right, we'll be right back.
And now it's time for Blowing Smoke.
And welcome back to the podcast. This is the Blowing Smoke segment where we talk to cool people about cool things. And since we recorded this one a while ago, we thought we should give you a little intro here. So if it sounds like really it's, we recorded this what in, was it May or July or?
Nah, dude, it was July.
Okay, yeah.
It was hot.
Yeah, we recorded this back in July at the
Vans Warped Tour.
We sat down with MC Lars to talk about a few things, and you know, we wanted to hold on to this episode till it got closer to his tour and new album release date. So as this podcast comes out, he is currently on tour. It's the Joyful Smiles Tours. You can find dates at mclars.com. And if you're in the Atlanta area, he's playing The Masquerade on October 4th. We're going to try to go to that show if I can get days off. starts at 6 p.m. And you can always go to the Haunted House afterward. Because there's a Haunted House.
Go check out Chamber of Horrors.
It's right behind it. Also, his new album, Zombie Dinosaur, the Zombies Dinosaur LP, is scheduled for release October 6th. So check that out. And we'll be dropping a track from that at the end of the interview. So here's our interview. And welcome back to the Cigar Nerds Podcast. We're here with MC Lars live at Vans Warped Tour. How's it going, man?
Hey, guys. How are you? I can't believe we survived the heat and the chaos.
Yeah, it's a little hot out here today, but, you know, that's what happens when you go to festivals in the summer. It's part of the experience. If you're not sweating, you're not doing it right.
I mean, just welcome to Georgia in general. I mean, here we are with 100% humidity, but you know what? Looks like everybody's having a good time. Lars, you put on a heck of a show, buddy.
Thank you, man.
You know, it's awesome being a part of it and, you know, just seeing the crowds come together and, you know, love supporting, you know, guys like you that are doing, you know, what it is, you know, with the music and everything. I mean,
yeah, I mean, the independent artist is like, you know, kind of like us. You know, we put this stuff out ourselves. We don't have anybody behind us. You know, we don't have any bosses. You know, we wanted to do this, so we did it. And we look up to guys like you that, you know, are doing that yourself on the big stage.
Thanks. Literally. Thank you. No, well, thank you. I'm impressed by your guys' hard work and your independent spirit. And it was nice. When did we first meet? A year ago?
Yeah, it was when you came to town with MC Chris last year, whenever that was at.
And it was at Drunken Unicorn?
Yes.
That was a joyful day.
Oh, yeah, it was awesome. So speaking of the music and everything else, for folks that may not be familiar with you, can we get a little bit of your background?
Yeah, no problem. Thanks. I started off in punk bands, and then I discovered hip-hop in college where I was studying literature. And I did a semester abroad in England, and I started rapping, opening for punk and indie bands in England. And I started sampling the bands that I would open for or tour with and making my own albums. And I started having a lot of literary songs because that was kind of like what I was studying. And it led to me being associated with the nerdcore guys like Frontalot and Chris. And I've been touring internationally since 2003, and it's kind of crazy. And it's my third summer on the Warped Tour, which is really cool because it's a really different market. It's young kids. It's very, it's different than the nerdcore world, I feel like, you know?
Yeah, certainly.
Yeah, I definitely dig it because, I mean, one of the things that, you know, nerdcore, writing about pop culture, video games, whatever, but, I mean, you get, like, literary nerdcore. I mean, who else is writing rap songs about Hamlet and Shakespeare and Edgar Allan Poe?
Thanks, man. They say write what you know and what you like to write about, you know? So that's what I do.
Yeah, you don't pull any punches with it either, too, because, I mean, it's like you can enjoy it on its own, but if you actually know those works, I mean, you're going deep into it.
High five. Boom, we just high-fived.
Yeah, I mean, college education has definitely shown through. I mean, and that was one of the things that inspired me. Like, you hear a lot of, you know, mainstream hip-hop and stuff, and I just can't get into it because I can't relate. There's really nothing, you know.
Yeah, with, like, you know, nerdcore, literary hip-hop, I mean, that's stuff that, it's a positive message and stuff that pretty much anybody that, you know, can get into, whether you're, you know, what walk of life you're in, you know, you can know about some of this, you know, nerd stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Lars, you've got a new album coming out soon.
Yeah, it's called the Zombie Dinosaur LP. I've been working on it for like a year, and I've got songs with Cool Keith and Watsky and Brian from I Fight Dragons. It comes out October 6th. And the new single, the first single is called Dragon Blood. It's my Game of Thrones song. Do you guys like Game of Thrones?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, that video, too, is insane.
Thanks, man. Yeah, the video's on YouTube, and we have Daenerys in an office kicking butt.
Certainly.
Yeah, we just went to see Terminator the other day. She was badass as Sarah Connor, yeah. We went Tuesday to see
it. Is Emilia Clarke Sarah Connor?
Yeah.
Wow.
I did not even recognize her until I was, like, checking out the credits. I'm like, holy crap.
It
doesn't even look like her. Sort of. It's, like, kind
of
like the timelines have all been, like, redone. So it's weird. It's almost redoing that 84 movie with... If you try to figure out the timeline, it'll give you a headache. It's weird.
I got to see it, man. That sounds awesome.
Oh. Yeah, I'm pretty stoked to... I got to get out there and see it myself.
Have you guys seen Jurassic World?
Yes.
Yeah, our last episode was our Jurassic Park episode.
Whoa!
So we rewatched all that stuff.
I'm trying to see it. I guess it ties in with a zombie dinosaur, right? Any like recreated dinosaur is almost like a zombie. I don't know.
Absolutely.
I mean, the regular dinosaurs are hard enough to take down. You throw some zombie dinosaurs in there, it's going to get wild.
Whoa, how are we picking up with this loud band behind us?
You know what? We're actually picking up surprisingly well, so...
Our mics are pretty focused.
I'm proud of you guys. You're so professional.
I don't know about that, but, I mean, we make it work.
You know what you're doing, you just have to act like you know what you're doing. That's our philosophy.
Everything else can be fixed in post.
So what's
I feel
the,
you.
What's some of the inspiration behind the new album?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I wanted to write... more pop culture stuff. Like, there's a song about Hans Moleman from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
There's a song about Who Framed Roger Rabbit. There's a song, but also there's like a Legend of Zelda song called Triforce about growing up. There's a song about, I have a song called Hipster Girl, and it's about her, the character from that becomes a mom. It's called Hipster Mom. So it's like building on old themes from my old records, really.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm super stoked, not only to check out the new album, but when are you going to be back in the Atlanta area?
I'm actually doing a fall U.S. tour, so I'm hoping to be back in Atlanta to headline. So I'll post about that, and you guys should come. It's going to be really, really exciting.
We'll definitely come back anytime you're nearby.
Thanks, man. Oh. I love coming down here. People in Atlanta are so supportive, and you have such a strong music scene. And plus, the hip-hop here is amazing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you definitely have a lot of inspiration and, you know, an eclectic group of people all coming together. I think, you know, Atlanta is one of those meccas that not a whole lot of cities have. I mean, you know.
Like, I've been to a lot of shows, and everyone is really, you know, comes together at these shows. There's no, like, drama that I've seen. I mean, here, you know, as hot and crowded as it is, I've not seen any kind of fights or stupidity. I mean, everyone's just having a good time, and that... I see that a lot at shows in Atlanta. It's a really good crowd down here.
Perfect. Well, anything else?
Well, we've been, ever since we heard True Player for Real, that's been our theme song. So we've changed it to True Podcaster for Real. So anytime we record,
cool.
We're like TPFR.
You can have it. You can have it. What's your guys' favorite cigar?
I think the probably Monte Cristo number 2.
Fancy trying to come up with some Cuban stuff. I mean, the main thing I've been smoking lately is the Rocky Patel Super Ligera. I always go for something strong that's going to, like, you know, give. I barely drink, so I smoke a strong cigar, I get the same effects.
Dude, you just go for the Super Ligera because that's what's in my humidor.
True. I mean,
with the Cuban deregulations, is it now easier to get Cuban cigars? What's the story now?
Well, so far, it's like there's a limit. You can only bring like $100 worth back in, which that's not going to be a whole lot of cigars. So for personal use, if you're going over there, you can actually bring back like a handful, but so far it's not kind of, the market's not gotten there yet, so it's still kind of hard to find them unless you're actually going or know someone who's going down there. But hopefully it's slowly like loosening up, so maybe in the next couple years we'll start seeing more cubids in the market.
But now they're not as illegal, right?
No, they're like, it's like I said, as long as you are under that, you know, $100 limit, you can import them.
This guy's awesome.
I mean, when it comes to our bad habits, I mean, we know our stuff typically.
We do research occasionally.
Perfect. Well, Lars, any final thoughts? Any, you know, thing you want to tell the listeners out there?
I just want to say these guys are really great. Keep listening to their podcasts. They're very patient. And their producer is a really good photographer, too. Check out the photos from today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We'll get these posted on the website.
Find you, follow you, check out all your social stuff. I'm
mclars.com, mclars Facebook, mclars Twitter. On Instagram, I'm mc_lars. And the new record's coming out, and I'm putting out a bunch of videos too. So stay tuned. And I'll spread the word. Thank you guys for having me on.
Awesome, man.
I burned the witch alive who took my son and husband's lives. But I survived so frisky, now these dragons have my back. Suitors are so frisky and they always try to mac. Zara, Zo, and Daxos had to lock him in a vault. Made my way to Slaver's Bay, but it was not my fault. It was karmic retribution. There was no preparing them, and Crassus tried to mess with the wrong Targaryen. I smarted him like Tyrion when I knew how Valyrian. These creatures on my shoulders, well, I think you should be fearing them. You are now watching the throne. I got dragon blood, what you wanna do, son? I got dragon blood, what you wanna do? I got dragon blood, what you wanna do, son? Cause I'm always going hard with my cracky crew. I got dragon blood, what you wanna do, son? I got dragon blood, what you wanna do? I got dragon blood, what you wanna do, son? Cause I'm always going hard with my cracky crew. The thracky, the thracky, the thracky, the thracky, unsullied behind me. Like I'm Luminati. It's the mother of dragons with my gigantic army. We be marching to Marine, but no, we didn't come to party. Cause they crucified the slaves and put them on the cross. Ser Jorah, please get lost. I know you think I'm hot. My schedule's kinda busy, got no time for Perrier. White girl politic, and that's Daenerys Palin. From Dorne to the Stormlands, the north and beyond. To the Westerlands and Essos, I'm keeping it strong. From the Crownlands to the Reach, you know I'm getting love. To the Riverlands and back, because I've got that dragon blood. So follow, more clueless. I thought that you knew this, but dragons aren't people, you know we've been through this. I'm quick to burn a hater, no mercy damage. Smacking kings in the face like my name was Cersei Lannister. Burn, burn, yes you're gonna burn. 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 I got dragon blood, what you wanna do, son? I got dragon blood, what you wanna do? I got dragon blood, what you wanna do, son? Cause I'm always going hard with my cracky crew. I got dragon blood, what you wanna do, son?
And welcome back to the podcast. Time for some science.
Oh, yeah. This is that segment where I get educated, right?
Yeah, supposedly get educated and forget it 5 minutes later.
It's like a cat video.
Cat videos.
I remember the chuckle. I don't necessarily remember the content of the video.
Well, you ready to dive back into virtual reality? Do some Ready Player One type stuff?
Absolutely. Where are you taking me this time?
To a not a galaxy far, far away, but this galaxy just a long time ago, in, or a long time in the future. There's a company has started the Enterprise 3D Construction Project, where they're building a full-scale edition of the Enterprise in virtual reality. So when the Oculuses and the other virtual reality devices get released early next year, you're going to be able to wander the full NCC-1701D from the next generation.
That is awesome. So, you know, all 42 decks have been, you know, built to date.
And well, no, that's the end of the project. It's going to take a long time. They've got a lot of the main segments of the ship, like the bridge, engineering, whatnot. But they are committed to completing the entire ship. Like I said, the saucer section is 6 foot football fields long. So it's going to take a while to get everything. And most of this stuff is stuff that was never on the actual TV show. So, they're having to create a lot of stuff from scratch. The lead programmer, like I said, he's using set photos, blueprints, you know, internet chatter. But it's the most realistic version of the Enterprise that's ever been created outside of Hollywood.
Yeah, I was just, you know, skipping ahead here a little bit. So, apparently, paint color, size ratios, dirt, and everything else is going to be a factor. So this is going to be a very impressive product.
Yeah, they're using the Unreal Engine 3 and 4, which is, you know, pretty much the best, you know, graphic engine that you can currently use. So it's going to look like you're in the Enterprise. And eventually they want to turn this into a interactive experience where it's going to be like a game where you can become the captain of the ship and fire the proton torpedoes and explore planets and all that other stuff, and actually be the captain. I mean, right now you can just kind of wander around an empty Enterprise and, hey, that looks cool. Let me go to 10 forward and order a beer. But eventually, like I said, it's going to be a populated world where you can be one of the crew.
I mean, I could see as folks age and pass on and everything else, dude, this thing's going to be like a museum of sorts.
Yeah, I mean, this is really my Enterprise. When I was watching Star Trek, I pretty much started with, you know, the Next Generation. So, and I even had like an old CD-ROM version where you could, you know, where it took you through some of the big sections, like the bridge, the engineering, the med bays, stuff like that. And you could scroll around and zoom in on stuff and read labels or whatnot. But yeah, once that, you know, Oculus Rift technology hits, it's going to be a cool experience where you're there. You can sit in the captain's chair and do all kind of other crazy stuff.
That's awesome.
Beam me up, Scotty.
So what's next on the old agenda?
Speaking of taking pictures and reality, selfies will kill you. I mean, we've already talked about, you know, taking too much selfies may be a sign that you're a narcissist or a psychopath. But
so is this going to lead down impelled by selfie stick, or where are we going with this?
Well, pretty much Mashables has done a study of reported deaths, and selfies kill more people each year than sharks.
Interesting. So how many selfie deaths do we have on average? I mean,
Right now for the year, it stands at 12 people have died from selfies, but only 8 people have been killed by sharks.
Interesting. So, I mean, I run into this a lot in my just in my travels, where people are, you know, looking down at their phone to send texts. I mean, I've watched people, you know, do everything from, you know, bump into people and get knocked the fuck out to, you know, basically, you know, nearly walking in traffic because they're paying more attention to their phone than they are the crosswalk signals.
Yeah, and like I said, the list of stuff is just, some of them are just tales of true stupidity, and not just, you know, not paying attention, taking a selfie on a cliff and falling off, or, you know, because normally you see people, especially people bringing out the selfie sticks, are not paying attention to their surroundings. But yeah, there was one reported death where a guy tried to take a selfie in the middle of the running of the Bulls, which did not go well.
Typically with that, you want to keep moving, correct?
Yeah. The Bulls are not going to stop chasing you just because you've decided to pull out a selfie.
I bet it was a red selfie stick.
You're going to get run the fuck down. In addition to that, I believe
he was not strong like Bull.
One report of somebody posing with a gun, trying to look all gangster, and then accidentally shooting themselves in the head while doing a selfie. Yeah.
So I think we need to do a a categorized edition of the Darwin Awards, and you know, have the
best selfie death.
Yes, 1,000 ways to die.
Yeah, I mean we saw somebody using a selfie stick this weekend while we were at Netherworld.
Yes, we did.
Oh yeah, like I said, selfie sticks for I don't get it. And like I said, those people are the best.
Although they are funny when used out of context.
Yeah, but they are the best. As a monster in a haunted house, I love seeing people taking selfies because they're or with their face buried in their camera, so they're or in their phone because they're so easy to sneak up on.
Yes.
I mean, I've scared so many people out in the lot just be playing on their phone or you know texting somebody and then just get up all in their face and they have no idea you're there because they're so self-absorbed with whatever they're doing on their phone.
Damn those narcissists.
Yep.
All right, and next on the agenda.
Have you watched Harry Potter?
You know what? I've seen bits and pieces. I've probably played more of the Harry Potter game than I have actual, you know, watched the movies.
Well, anyone who's watched Harry Potter and who's also a pervert and would like to, you know, be able to sneak into locker rooms undetected, scientists have come up with a working version of the invisibility cloak.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. I like the invisibility cloak on Crisis 3. It's kind of like, you know, where you're going with this, I think.
Yeah, scientists at UC Berkeley, Yung Wang, Zijing Wang, and Zing Zhang, or however you pronounce his name, just published in the Journal of Science something they're calling an ultra-thin invisibility skin cloak for visible light. Basically, you know, light plays a big part of actually seeing stuff. You know, the angles and the, you know, that's how we kind of detect size, shape, distance, all this stuff. With this cloak, it converts it all to make it look like light is coming from a flat object. Then can also not only conceal it, but project what's behind it and just blend in with the environment around it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen this used on, you know, essentially mirrors, you know, of tree houses and things of that nature to make them blend in with their surroundings and everything else out in the middle of the woods. So, you know, definitely create some interesting hides.
Yeah, I mean, this stuff is made with these tiny, tiny gold blocks they're calling nano antennas that basically bend light around the object and, you know, makes it look almost like, you know, because it conforms to the size and the shape of whatever it's concealing. You know, it looks pretty much like the Predator vision. So, I mean, we could be a really badass Predator cosplay that no one would be able to see.
Just have three laser pointers.
Yeah.
Shit, why do I have these dots on me?
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, that's not only is something just cool to play with, I mean, but our, you know, if you remember the one of the last James Bond movies that came out with the invisible Aston Martin.
Yes. Yep, I remember all too well.
And of course, as I said, it'll definitely have military implications or uses, or even one who's played like, you know, some of the games with like the stealth soldiers and stuff where, yeah, pretty much basically Predator vision.
Sweet. Yeah,
which was always a pain in the ass playing Knights of the Old Republic with the stealth soldiers. Like, why does this something look funny? Oh no, now that invisible shadow is shooting at me. There's somebody there. Freaking pain in the ass.
Yeah, I recall some of my struggles in the world of the Halo video games. Invisible man, next energy sword, instant death every time. Damn it. Yes.
I mean, hey, it'd be great for haunted houses too, man. If I can like completely disappear, you don't even need a hiding spot. You can just hide in plain sight and jump out at people. It'd be pretty awesome.
That would be interesting. Yes, I would have too much fun with that. That is not technology I should have access to.
Hey, man, sneaking to concerts for free—you ain't got to pay for a ticket. It's all good. But then I'd probably fire up a cigar, and people are like, "Where's that smoke coming from?"
Give away the cloak.
Yeah. And,
it seems as if you...
And next up, we're going to Mars, man.
That's awesome.
And I'm not just talking about a Matt Damon movie.
So, I mean, what are the benefits of going to Mars?
Like, I don't know.
What's there?
Rocks.
Rocks?
We don't know a whole lot about it, but yeah, I mean, but since the shuttle program's done, we need to do something else to explore space. But yeah, NASA's saying we're farther down the path to sending humans to Mars than any point in NASA's history. And they've kind of set a date of when they think we'll, they said we should be expected to set foot on Mars by 2030.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I'm a little bit opposed with Mars just from the aspect that I played Doom 3. I know what happens on Mars. It's not good.
Yeah, there's demons on Mars, or what's that bad Ice Cube movie, Ghosts of Mars? There's demons and ghosts in Mars.
I needed to forget that.
I mean, they're saying it's, like I said, it's another 15 years or so. But, like I said, we have a lot of steps to cover before we can actually send a manned mission to Mars. But NASA is starting to set up those steps that it would take. And they've actually put in a plan of this is how we're going to do it. And one of the next things that we're going to be doing is when the next Mars rover launches in 2020 is we're going to try to create oxygen on Mars. Kind of like if anybody remembers Total Recall.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like with this, it's almost like a precursor to the disaster film, right? I mean, NASA's like, oh, we're doing this just for the exploration. Really, they know that in 50 years there's something that's going to wipe out the world.
There's an Armageddon-style asteroid heading toward us that we need to plan for. The next rover is going to be carrying something they're called the Mars Oxygen ISRU, or MOXIE. As they're calling it, it basically will take the carbon dioxide out of the thin Martian atmosphere and try to produce oxygen, kind of like plants take carbon dioxide out of our atmosphere and release oxygen. We're going to try to produce air not only for eventual explorers to breathe, but one of the main ingredients in rocket fuel is oxygen.
Oh yeah. So, well, you don't get fire without oxygen. Yeah. So,
like I said, rockets that do actually go to Mars, they'll be able to create fuel from the oxygen for the return trip, which is going to make it easier so we don't have to carry as much reserve fuel to get to Mars. I mean, that's one of the things that's going to make the trip easier is, like I said, if there's a way to refuel when we get there, we don't have to carry as much supplies on the way.
Where the hell are they getting the money for this stuff, and how do I figure out how to tap into that revenue stream?
I'm just going to have to, join Virgin Galactic or something.
Yeah, I just got to become an astrophysicist. It'll be okay.
And the writer of the book The Martian that Andy Weir, that the new Matt Damon movie is based on, he's like, he doesn't think, he thinks 2030 is a little bit overreaching because Congress has to fund all this NASA stuff and you know how that goes. So. But he says,
dude,
we should be there by 2050.
Money talks.
Like I said, 2030, maybe not, but he thinks by at least 2050 we should be there and checking out Martians and whatnot. Or I guess we'd be the Martians at that point. Since right now, Mars is only populated by robots.
How do we know?
There probably is life on Mars. They're just avoiding the robots that we have out there. It's like the whole time, the robot's looking around, there's some Martian standing behind it, just out of camera view going, what the fuck is this thing?
Well, I mean, either that or they look at us like the virus. Like, they look at us consuming, the Earth's natural resources and everything else, saying, damn, we don't want those things around us. They're going to consume us, too.
The Earthlings are assholes. Yes. Either that or there's, our rover just landed in, the middle of a desert or somewhere, and, there's, a city on the other side of a mountain that we just don't see.
Yes.
All right, and with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
And now it's time for all things nerdy in Nerd News.
And welcome to Nerd News, folks.
Yeah.
This is where we're going to talk about some movies, some other things coming up, some things that future, past, and present. Up first, Doctor Who. We had the first episode of season 9. Yeah, the Doctor. That's all you need to know.
Okay.
He's the man in the blue box that just happens to be bigger on the inside. So for season 9 premiered, just a few days ago on BBC One. And I gotta say, this episode for me was absolutely awesome. Just seeing the Doctor, you know.
Yeah, there's nothing more badass than riding in on a tank playing a guitar solo.
Yes, as he gets involved in a an axe fight. It's like, oh, in a couple hundred years, you'll get that reference. Which I thought was absolutely awesome. Yeah, you know, Jenna Coleman, she has returned as Clara for the third and final season in the role. And I'm going to be sad to see her go.
Yeah, she's been a pretty good companion. I'm just interested to see how they're going to get rid of her. I mean, anyone who has seen the episode, the latest episode, I'm not sure that's going to be her actual final episode, because, I mean, they always give the companions exit more fanfare than that. It was just way too simple.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it leads into a bigger backstory. Maybe the Doctor's, you know, a first regeneration or something of that nature. I don't know. You know, I'm curious to see how the season progresses from here on out. So, you know, definitely a little bit of a cliffhanger and some uncertainty in the Doctor's future and humanity's future alike.
So what you got next?
Up next, so got to see the, you know, Good Morning trailer for Marvel's Jessica Jones Netflix series. And I say Jessica Jones, probably the female epitome of me. I'm the type of person that's going to hit my snooze button 15 times. No, she doesn't hit a snooze button. She just destroys the entire clock.
Yeah, I mean, superheroes don't like mornings either. I mean, you got a little super strength there. Just crush the freaking
yeah, absolutely.
Alarm clock. Oh, yeah, so definitely a teaser trailer because it don't show much other than that. But we do get a release date for that. Looks like it's going to be November 20th when that's set to premiere on your Netflixes.
Yeah, and I got to say, you know, Netflix has did an awesome job with the Punisher series. You had an opportunity to
Daredevil.
Daredevil, yeah, not Punisher.
We're still waiting on Punisher.
Punisher's in the mix. I'm confident they're going to do a good job on that one. They better do a good job on that one. Otherwise,
I mean, it's got Shane
from
The Walking Dead. It looks like it's going to be pretty badass.
But yeah, stay the hell out of Hell's Kitchen. Does not look like a good place to be.
There's some bad shit happening there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm just like, damn. So,
yeah, I don't know much about the character of Jessica Jones. So, but I mean, I like that actress. She's been in a few things, and she's always been pretty cool. So yeah, I'm looking forward to the next installment of the Marvel Netflix universe.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. You know, like I said, they've done a phenomenal job with everything up to this point. So I don't know. They've set a really high bar for me, and I don't see them going backwards. I mean, you know, they're pulling some big name actors and actresses, and you know, they're doing a hell of a job. So
yeah, and the whole like Netflix, like I said, it's there's not the constraints that have on, like, you know, say Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. That they're allowed to show more and do more, and it's been more of a darker, grittier corner of the Marvel universe.
Yeah, and I gotta say, I appreciate that aspect of things. I mean, I think that's really going to play well with the Punisher films.
Yeah,
like trying to do the, you know, a Punisher animated series or something like that, or, you know, just a TV series for the would not do, you know, that graphic
Which
novel
the,
justice.
The anime Punisher Black Widow cartoon is pretty badass, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do say that that's pretty good. So I had the opportunity earlier today to sit down and watch the first episode of the Guardians of the Galaxy animated series, and I gotta say,
I am Groot.
Yeah, there was a lot of Groot references. I mean, it was kind of weird, you know, hearing the characters voiced by other actors and actresses. But you know, by and large, I mean, you know, the score of the cartoon film, as far as the music and stuff. I mean, it was funny. It, you know, had enough action to keep you captivated and hold your attention. Yeah,
was the music as good as the awesome mix, though?
You know, on a lesser degree. The music itself wasn't any, you know, less awesome, but, you know, you only got a 43-minute series versus, you know, a 2.5-hour movie, which...
Oh, wow, it's a full 43 minutes.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm not seeing any of it yet. I gotta check that up. I gotta add it to my DVR list.
So yeah, I mean, there's definitely some awesome humor and some puns taken at Groot and stuff of that nature. So
yeah, because I've seen them. They've done Guardians episodes on the whatever Ultimate Spider-Man series and on the a couple of the Avengers cartoons. And those always have been like real good episodes. So I'm glad to see them doing getting a full their own show.
Absolutely. So you can check that out on Disney XD. So like I said, you know, really suited my fancy. Up next is some movie news. And
you have a fancy.
Yeah. I'm fancy, huh? So the new Men in Black trilogy won't include Will Smith. And to me, I don't see how you do Men in Black without Will Smith.
I don't know. That last Men in Black that didn't have Tommy Lee Jones, and it was the first and second one were good. That third one was just kind of weak.
Yeah, I mean, they were playing off the success of the first two films, but they took away that energy and that character dynamic. You know, we kind of talked about the buddy cop films in previous episodes, yeah, and stuff, and Men in Black always kind of had that jive to it.
Yeah, Men in Black 3 is almost just a Will Smith solo film, and it just does not stand up to the other two. So they kind of messed up that dynamic.
Yeah, absolutely. So I gotta say, you know, with this, I don't necessarily have high hopes for it. I mean,
have they given any kind of indication of who they're casting or any other details about it?
I mean, basically, you know, not really a whole lot of details there. I mean, they're just, you know,
hey, we're doing this, but yeah, we don't know anything about it yet.
I mean. Right, we're kind of going down that Star Wars path, right? Where they're like, we're doing something.
You'll see it in a couple of months.
You'll see it, but we're not going to tell you anything about it in the meantime. And, you know, Star Wars, I think they can get away with it because Star Wars.
Yeah, I don't see there wasn't a huge calling for a new Men in Black series.
Yeah, I mean, especially another trilogy at that. I mean, it just, I don't know. I'll probably give it a shot, but I do not have high expectations.
Especially if it's going to be like a reboot. And like I said, I have a long-standing hatred of reboots.
I haven't been too enthralled with many of the reboots. I mean, I'm about ready for Hollywood to start coming up with some original ideas. Yeah. You know, I think Netflix and, you know, the way they're going, I think some of these, you know, big budget, you know, Hollywood companies need to take a look at that model because they've got some serious competition on their hands as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about, you know, what little we know about Spider-Man and Civil War is it's already been announced.
Who the fuck is Tom Holland?
Exactly. That Spider-Man is already going to be Spider-Man by the time we see him in Civil War, because there's only so many ways you can kill Uncle Ben. They've already rebooted it twice. I'm sick of seeing the Spider-Man origin story. We know it already. Let's just get into the shit of it.
Yeah, I'm ready to see Spider-Man come into his own, do some badass things, and you know, be the Spider-Man from the comic instead of just I don't know, you know, some of the ways that he's been portrayed. I mean, I don't know. It's kind of up there with the Superman franchise for me. Like a lot of the Superman films, I just can't get behind. They've sucked ass. So you know, I mean, when it comes to Spider-Man. Jump ahead, fast forward a little bit, let's get to the nitty-gritty, the action, and stop trying to retell that same story over and over again.
Yeah, it's like, was it Brandon Routh in whenever Superman Returns or whatever that movie he was in? As much as I hate him as Superman, he is awesome on Arrow. I think he's badass as the Atom.
I think that's just a prime example of casting somebody that doesn't quite fit, you know, that character's dynamic. I mean, you know, seeing him cast in Arrow, he plays that hand. It's believable. It's an awesome role for him. But that's not the Superman role.
Yeah.
Up next is we've got our first look at the Batmobile from Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice.
All right, we're going to pick up one.
I don't know yet. I mean, there is a contest going on that two lucky winners will receive an Ultimate Studio experience, which includes a chance to actually sit inside the Batmobile.
Yeah, I would drive off on it. It'd be
So looking at this thing, I mean, you know, we're almost getting into it. You know, almost has that off-road vehicle look that we saw from, you know, the other Batman films. I mean,
yeah, this is kind of like a smaller, sleeker version of the Tumbler from the other Dark Knight movies.
Yeah, I mean, but it's also been beefed up a little bit. I mean, dude, this thing I think would make a badass RC car. Like,
it's almost the Bat Tank. If anybody remember the Dark Knight Returns animated movie, it kind of has that feel. It's definitely like, this thing looks like it's made for battle. It's not just a car. And this thing is like, yeah, definitely made to like blow shit up.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm wondering where the kryptonite's hidden on this thing.
It's a lot like the Batmobile in the new Arkham game.
Have you had an opportunity to play much of that? Or
not yet. Just not what videos I've seen of it. I still got to upgrade my system to a PS4 before I can...
Yeah, I'm still having a hard time dropping, you know, $400-$500 on video game systems, and then, you know, the video game's coming at you at another $60 a piece. Like, I'm almost being priced out of that market. I think that's why I'm still, you know, reverting back to my retro games. Plus, the playability of them is, you know, span the years of 30 years of my life that, you know, I've enjoyed these games. So, probably not going anywhere anytime soon as far as that aspect. So, that's what I've got for Nerd News. Joe, anything additional that you know that may be going on out there that folks should be aware of?
No, other than, like I said, the Doctor Who stuff and Jessica Jones was like the last nerdy things I saw. With that, you can check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com. Follow us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever podcasts are found. Hit us up on Facebook at Cigar Nerd, at Cigar Nerds on Facebook. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Cigar Nerd Pod. We're also on the ESO Network, so check it out at ESOPodcast.com and check out all the other shows on the network. And with that, do you like coffee? Scream for the cream. And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast. We're your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.